93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steven Hyden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Steven Hyden. Before we begin, I want to thank you all for listening. Last week, we were firmly ensconced among the top 20 music podcasts on iTunes, which is a great turnout for a relatively new show. Please, if you like Celebration Rock, spread the word. Give us a good rating on iTunes, or tell your friends to check us out, or talk about an episode you liked on social media. Remember, this is your show too. Your support means so much. Today's show is a big one. We're counting down the best rock albums of the decade so far. I'm talking 2010, right up to this morning. When I decided to do this, there was only one person I thought to call, and that is Ian Cohen. You might know him as a writer for Pitchfork, Noisy, and Wandering Sound. He's also a good friend and a guy with smart and potentially polarizing opinions on pretty much every record you put in front of him. He was a natural to help me choose the defining rock albums of our time. One other note. If you want to hear songs from all the albums we discuss in this episode, head over to the Celebration Rock Twitter page for links and playlists. You can find us at Cele Rock Pod. Again, that's C-E-L-E Rock Pod. Okay, now let's get to the conversation. You know, we've talked a lot over email, but I think we've only met in person twice, and this might be our first phone conversation. Is that true?
Have we met twice? I know we've met once. I'm trying to remember the second time.
I met you once at Pitchfork, and another time at your you were doing an emo night in L.A.
Right. Really spanning the poles of my existence. you see me at my best.
Yes, LA's foremost emo DJ, Ian Cohen. So you were the first person I thought of when I wanted to do a best rock albums of the decade so far podcast. And because I know you and I are fairly simpatico as far as how we view where rock music is right now. But there's also not total agreement. You know, looking at our lists, there's a fair amount of overlap, but I know there's at least like maybe one or two records on my list that you would object to, or I'm anticipating you objecting to. I'm cool with everything on your list, but it'll be fun to get into it. Before we start doing the countdown, I wanted to ask you sort of like a big picture question. You know, right now, you know, this is going to be airing in 2016. You know, it's an interesting era for rock music right now. You know, usually when critics write about rock music, it's talking about it being in a period of decline, you know, like a long-term period of decline. And one of the reasons I thought to talk to you for this podcast is that you're one of the only critics that I know who's like actually interested in rock music right now and where it's at and keeping up with bands. What's your take right now on where rock is this decade? Like,
well, I mean, I think the fact that we, you know, that we're doing a podcast that like strictly focuses on rock music can give you a pretty good indication of where it's at. You know, the fact that it can be seen as, I don't know, like a subgenre or what have you. And, you know, you could definitely get like a number of like, you know, music writers on this podcast to talk about rock music and they tell you something differently. It's just, you know, if you got someone from who's like primary quarry is like Rolling Stone, like just this year, I mean, like Rolling Stone put like Bach, Skaggs, and Mark Knopfler, and you know, James Taylor on their year end list. So I mean, and so you could take that as an indication, or you know, you could go further.
Hey, don't sleep on Skaggs. Skaggs, it's bringing the heat.
Yeah, no, or Don Henley too. Or you know, you could bring someone in, you know, from the world of like, let's say, alt press or absolute punk, where you know, you look at a cover and it's like, you know, Panic at the Disco still in 2015, or like All Time Low. You know, so it's pretty healthy in that world as realm as well. But I would think that like rock music, as we're describing it, like people in our realm who like kind of run astride the indie world, it's not really healthy. I don't know if it's like unhealthy or whatever, because when you look at like certain records from this past year that you've discussed, you know, like let's say Alabama Shakes or whatever, or, you know, My Morning Jacket, I don't really feel that those bands' futures are in danger, you know? I would say that, like, as far as, like, indie rock music goes, I think we're in a place of, like, retrenchment. I mean, you look at 2009, for example. Like, I was thinking about, like, that recently. I was interviewing someone who said that Japandroids, like, Post Nothing, like, that record kind of, like, changed his whole perspective on indie rock because, before the decade started, I think it was, like, there was less exciting developments in rock music, like, in 2009 or even 2008, for that matter.
Well, 2009 was sort of the peak of, like, a certain kind of indie music represented by, like, Animal Collective, Grizzly Bear.
Yeah.
The sort of arty underground music, which I like a lot of those records, but they're not... But if you were to compare them to, like, Japandroids, for instance, Japandroids is certainly represents something grittier, more punk rock.
Yeah, I would say that, like, in 2008, 2009, like, as we were going into the new decade, you know, you would have the first records by, like, Titus Andronicus and, like, Japandroids and such, you know, before they made that, like, second record Leap. And, I mean, yeah, if you look at the turn, before the turn of the decade, and, like, I would say that, like, indie rock was, like, you know, it was very kind of, like, arty, and you could see the kind of backlash that happened with the most recent Animal Collective song. That's kind of been phased out or what have you, and we're kind of seeing, like, a retrenchment, I think, more towards 90s value. You know, things are more resembling Pavement, things are more resembling, you know, like Liz Phair or like Slater Kenny from the 90s. Like, sonically and, you know, politically and, like, lyrically, you're seeing more of, like, a retrenchment towards a time when indie rock was, like, a smaller thing, and you could see that with, like, this, you know, what's going on with, like, Exploding in Sound or, like, Double Double Whammy or, like, the scenes in, like, Boston and Philadelphia and New York or, like, New Pulse or whatever, where, you know, they have more visibility than they would have in the 90s, but still not, like, going for it the way the records that we're going to talk about today are. You know, it's like, more like the 90s rather than, like, the middle of the 2000s. Like, middle of the 2000s, you had, like, you know, the National, like, Wolf Parade or... you know, that whole, or Overville River, where the bands, like, didn't really sound like they came from strictly, like, an indie rock standpoint. There was something larger. Now, like, rock music, you have it, like, as far as it goes in indie rock, it's a much, much smaller thing.
Right. And there seems to be a thing now where, you know, you were talking about, you know, where indie rock was at the end of 2000s. There was certainly a sort of natural escalation that happened in the 2000s, where there was this idea that, you know, that it was going to be sort of like the alt rock era, where there were bands that started off in indie rock and they were going to get gradually more and more popular and become mainstream bands. And I think when you talk about 2009, you know, the big sort of emblematic indie rock record of that year was the Animal Collective record.
Dirty Projectors, like, it was like those three, Dirty Projectors, Dirty Projectors, Animal Collective, and Grizzly Bear were like, for like the Pearl Jam, Nirvana, and like Soundgarden.
Right. And those were, they were, you know, arty indie rock bands. You know, the like, when people say the term indie rock, they have a certain picture in their heads.
Yeah.
And those bands sort of looked like those bands. But like in 2009, they all made their sort of pop records. You know,
yeah.
Merriweather Post Pavilion was like, there was Animal Collective's pop record. And
you I don't even know if you could call those bands, like, rock. I mean, Grizzly Bear, yes, I think.
Yeah.
But, like, Animal Collective, like, really, like, stood apart. Like, they're only, like, a rock band in the sense that, like, they have, like, you know, four guys playing instruments on stage. Otherwise, they have, like, very, very little in common with, like, I would say, like, what we would, you know, most of the rock, like, what people would consider rock. It was more indie than it was rock. So I think... we're kind of conflating two things, don't we?
Right. Yeah, I mean, and that's an argument that a lot of people have made against indie music in the 2000s, that sort of the punk roots of that music were sort of set aside at that time, because there wasn't a lot of, like, a lot of riffs being written in the 2000s. And leading up to where we are right now, I mean, It's interesting when we talk about the term rock, because I feel like there's a lot of things happening in pop music right now that if it were 30 years ago would be classified as rock music. For instance, Taylor Swift writes confessional songs on a guitar and plays them in an arena. You know, 30 years ago, that would have she would have been classified as a rock artist. Now she's classified as either country or pop. Certainly, you know, I mean, large swaths of what country music is now would have been called heartland rock in the 80s. You know, Eric Church being the most obvious example.
Yeah, but I think he's you know, making the heartland rock, it's got more of an accent. Like, you know, you didn't hear, like, even like Cougar and like Seeger, they have like very, very American accents rather than like Southern or country. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
I mean, it seems like the issue now when we talk about rock music is that it doesn't really have an identity as far as the mainstream goes, that there's not like, you know, I guess you could say the Foo Fighters are like the closest thing to like an emblematic rock act. You know, they play stadiums and people know who they are. But, you know, the Foo Fighters originated in the 90s, and obviously Dave Grohl was part of Nirvana. And, you know, to say that they're like a new band is obviously a stretch. And, you know, looking at the records on our list, it is interesting that you talk about that retrenchment. I mean, it does seem that like this is the first decade maybe where bands, like rock bands, aren't even really even attempting to be pop bands, that they are looking at themselves as being rock bands in that sort of genre, part of that continuum, appealing to a certain audience, and not going for the brass ring in the way that bands in the 90s did, or bands even in the 2000s did to a lesser degree.
Yeah. I mean, when I look at, like, I mean, 2005 as being like what I consider, I guess, like the height of, or 2004, like when, you know, the first Arcade Fire record came out, like, or Broken Social Scene, or that matter. I mean, I don't think those bands were like specifically going for a big, I mean, not like, they weren't intentionally going, but the music itself, like, sounded big. Like, it didn't really, like, evolve from that, like, okay, then you had, like, first you had the Pixies, then you had, like, Pavement, and then you, like, went on to Built Still or whatever. Like, that kind of, like, very, very linear narrative, like, that very, very linear, what's the word, bloodline, I guess. They, you know, it's not, like, it was just, like, larger in the sense that, like, they incorporated more instruments. The music, like, that's when you started to see, I think, bands, like, really taking, like, U2 and, like, Bruce Springsteen, and, like, that was starting to, like, win, and even the Hold Steady, you can say, did that. That's when bands would start to, like, look towards, like, the big arena acts, but, like, from an indie standpoint. Like, it was, you know, or even, like, Destroyer, for that matter. And that's what was exciting to me about that time, and I think the best the music that I put on my list, you know, for the current day, does that to a degree as well. It doesn't pick from like the same kind of sources, but whereas now the influences that you see are very strict in terms of like what they're looking for. It's like, you know, that whole like thing with like Pavement, Built to Spill, Guided by Voices, you know, all of which are great bands, but like none of them like have that sort of expanse, I think. And that's sort of why you're seeing, you know, we could talk a whole lot about, like, you know, whether it's just, like, the writers that are writing or, you know, whatever. But the music that, like, you would qualify as, like, you know, straight-up indie rock now doesn't sound, like, big enough to compete with, like, you know, the like pop music or, like, rap or R&B, which, you know, have bigger personalities and bigger sounds. And it's just, like...
Oh, yeah. I mean, there used to be a difference. There used to be, you know, like, a stratification that went on where... You had pop music over here, you had hip-hop over here, and you had indie rock over here, and they weren't necessarily expected to compete with each other. Now, you know, those barriers are kind of gone, so it's like, if you're going to compare, you know, a band that plays basement shows to, like, you know, Drake or something, obviously, the disparity in production values is going to be a little bit different, and if you're looking for just maybe the immediate thing... you know, one is going to look more, you know, is going to look flashier and more enticing at first glance, and then something else. I mean, you know, and this is going to be something that we get into once we get to the list, but, you know, one thing that you and I agree on is that there is right now, you know, the new indie rock or the new alternative rock, and it's not really called that. It's called punk or it's called emo, and it's still sort of segregated away from where indie rock is talked about. That's changing, and that's changed actually that's changed a fair amount, even in the past year, where you see certain publications writing about certain kinds of bands. But as far as rock bands that actually appeal to kids, appeal to teenagers, indie rock is not the things that we call indie rock. That's not where that's at. But there is this, generation of young punk and emo bands that are, attracting that kind of audience.
I think that's it depends who you're talking. Because if you're talking about someone Alex G, who I don't think would be considered, punk or emo or whatever. I mean, you get loyal audiences with them. These audiences are popping up. I would say that.
Or Tame Impala, for instance, I guess.
Tame Impala is an exception.
They get classified as indie rock, but especially on their last record, they were, they branched off into, sort of music festival.
I think what we're talking about here is that sort of gap between, what is considered mainstream rock, bedrock indie bands such as Deer Hunter or Real Estate or Mac DeMarco and the untouchable Warped Tour or K-Rock thing, where you have your Muse and your Imagine Dragons or Latter-day Weezer or whatever. There's that gap that I think that we're referring to where no one really knows what to do with it. And then you find bands in situations like that as well. It'll be interesting to see when all these kids who are 16 grow up,
Yeah, I was at a Modern Baseball show a couple weeks ago, and, I was the oldest person there. Easily.
Twice the age of some people.
Yeah, exactly. And it does make you think that, okay, these kids are all going to grow up, and, in about 5 years, the type of music that they like, that maybe isn't getting a lot of respect or a lot of press right now.
Or maybe
that's
change. Just be told to grow out of it, It's
right.
It's shit you listen to and you could, talk about Modern Baseball in the past as it's something you used to listen to, which, I think a lot of bands that have become more respected as, Brand New, for example. People are super into them, but at the same time they're not considered a proper bedrock influence. That was probably something you used to listen to,
right?
Regardless of, but yeah, it's.
But again, I think that's in the process of evolving. Think that people that say that now. I mean, we saw something interesting with this when, Scott Weiland passed away.
Yeah.
As we're recording this, he died only a few days ago, but I was really surprised at the outpouring of just warm remembrances for Stone Temple Pilots, from people, because in their day they were critically reviled. They were one of the punchline bands. They were whatever Nickelback is now. Stone Temple Pilots were treated like that in the 90s. And I saw one music critic who I won't say this person's name, but you and I are both familiar with this person, and they're a famous crank. But they were talking about how, this is just revisionism, and when the guy from Collective Soul dies, then we're gonna have, the same thing. Which, maybe that's true. Maybe there will be a lot of Collective Soul fans. But it's not revisionism. It's people who didn't have a voice before saying that they love this thing that was trashed in the press. I mean, that's the difference. It's revisionism if it's the same people who decide that they've changed their mind. But what this is what happens with a lot of bands is that the people that loved this band when they were kids, they grow up and then they will defend that thing against the people that they grew up reading, and that that's happened for decades,
And it'll happen again. I mean, you're seeing it right now with for the most part, I guess most bigger public, whether it's Rolling Stone or Pitchfork or Spin or whatever. You're seeing people who grew up, on R&B when, beginning of the decade, R&B was, extremely more interesting than, modern rock or whatever. It's just this is what I grew up on. And it evolved in a certain way where this is understood amongst you and your peer group as being, the bedrock. And, Weiland is, I think you really hit on the definition of revisionism. Like, I think that with Stone Temple Pilots, I mean, it's not going to happen with Collective Soul. I mean, like, Stone Temple Pilots were, like, have, like, a body of work, which I believe is, you know, pretty, it stands up to, like, Collective Soul or, like, Candlebox or whatever. Or,
well, in Collective Soul, I mean, you know, if we're going to get into the Collective Soul discussion, and we're getting very far afield from our list talk, we have to get to that very soon. I did not expect to be talking about Collective Soul, but, you know, they did have, you know, and there are going to be people rolling their eyes because I'm going to mount a semi-defensive Collective Soul right now. But, you know, they did have a couple of, like, good radio singles that if they come on the radio now, you're like, oh, that's a solidly crafted song. You know, as far as their albums go, there's not much of a pedigree there. I mean, you know, unless you're, like, a serious soul head out there. Maybe there's serious soul heads listening to this right now who are going to say
I'm a people from Stockbridge, Georgia, believe me.
Okay, well, maybe they're out there, but, like, you know, but I think Stone Temple Pilots, you know, certainly, like, Purple and Tiny Music were albums that, even in their day, they were defenders of those albums. And over
and
time,
you have to look at the fact that, like, you know, the reason you have so many people coming up to defend a band like Stone Temple Pilots now is that, like, most people, I think, experience their music as somewhat of a captive audience. Like, for the most part, like, I'm not speaking generally, but, like, if maybe my experience is, like, the normal one where you grow up in, like, the suburbs and, like, you don't have a cool older brother or, like, you know, the college radio. It's, like, your options were probably MTV and, like, rock radio. And thus, you know, if those were your only options as a teen, like, yeah, you're going to hear some Stone Temple Pilots. Whereas nowadays, whatever version, you don't have to listen to whatever the version might be nowadays, you know?
Right.
So I think that's just, like, maybe it's, like, the last of its kind where, you know, people who are in their 20s or 30s who've written these not even defenses, but just, like, reminiscences, are, you know, had a limited number of outlets which to engage with pop music. And, you know, like, they sold, like, 5 million records of pop. I mean, like...
Yeah, well, they're definitely a band, too, that, like, I think a lot of people had to be told that they sucked.
Yeah, I you know, like, when me. They...
Like, when a lot of people heard, you know, Interstate Love Song, you know, for the first time, they probably thought, oh, that's a really cool song. And then they read, you know, in Spin or something that, no, this band sucks. And
that was my experience.
Right. And I think that's a pretty common thing. The thing I always think about with Stone Temple Pilots is that, like, Rolling Stone did, like, a reader's poll in 1994, and Purple was either won the album's poll or was tied for number one. And, like, Rolling Stone actually, like, chided its readers for you know, voting for this album.
Yeah,
you know?
And that's, like, the same infamous story where, like, you know, Pinkerton was named the worst album by Rolling Stone. Well, the legend has it was named the worst album of the year. It was actually named the third worst behind, like, I forget, it was, like, Bush and DJ Spooky. Yeah, I just want to...
Was that Razorblade Suitcase that they...
Yeah, that would be 1996.
Yeah, well, you know...
And you know what, like, if Gavin Rossdale dies, like... You know, not to get all morbid and shit, but I think people be able to now, if not as vigorous of a defense of him as they did with Scott Weiland, because, like, Bush was, like, far less artsy and far less, like, they were far more mercenary, I think. But yeah, I mean, you'll get some people saying, yeah, this guy was, you know, they had some fucking good songs, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, so yeah, I think that's just kind of. Yeah, I think that's just, like, more a product of people growing up with, like, a limited number of options.
Right.
And, I mean, like, when Pitchfork, like, when we voted on the best songs of the 90s, like, I think that was either 2009 or 2010. I mean, just the difference in perspective between, like, people who are my age and, like, the people who are 3 years older was just, like, I mean, like, it was like we grew up in different decades, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know... especially with 90s music, I mean, there is a big difference between the early 90s and, like, the late 90s, you know, because for certain, if let's say you were in middle school in 1998, you probably loved Blink-182 way more than someone who was in high school, you know, 3 or 4 years earlier.
Exactly. But also, you know, it was like, in the 90s, like, Pavement, and, I mean, even if they did share kind of, they did rub elbows a bit on, like, MTV, you know, one being on, like, 120 Minutes. I mean, like, I don't think them and, like, you know, Stone Temple Pilots were, like, playing the same game. Whereas nowadays, it's like, you know, whoever those versions, those bands are, kind of are, you know?
Well, I mean, and just the, I mean, I think now, too, there's a novelty to, like, a rock band that could write really good singles that get on the radio. I mean, that's sort of, I think there's a fresh appreciation for that now that there wasn't back then. In a way, it was almost like you're cheating or something if you wrote a really hooky song, whereas now it's sort of like, wow, that's kind of incredible that you could be a rock band and have a hit single. Okay, now we could talk about this for a long time.
We
gotta get to the task at hand. And this is the best rock albums of the decade so far, so let's get down to it. And since I'm a good host, I'm gonna let you go first with your number 10 choice.
All right, my number 10 choice. Now, I knew this was gonna like shift a little, but I would say that I think for what did I put at number 10? I think I put like Joyce Manor at number 10.
Yes, Joyce Manor, Never Hung Over Again, which came out in what, 2014?
That was 2014. Yeah, and for me, that record, I'll never ever get tired of listening to it.
Can you tell people a little bit about Joyce Manor first? Because they're
Joyce Manor is like, I think, perhaps the most emblematic of the bands that we talk about when we say that, you know, they kind of rise up, like, and I don't know, like, what sort of terminology I can use. Like, the way I think of it is, like, they're a band that would play Fest. Now, for people who aren't sure of what Fest is, it's like a three-day festival that happens in during Halloween weekend in Gainesville, Florida, where you see, like, you know, an example of, like, a headlining band there would be, like, the Descendants or, like, Desaparecidos. It's that really kind of, it's not Warped Tour, but it's still not indie enough to be, like, you know, on the radar of Coachella, even though, like, Joyce Manor have played Coachella now. But, you know, they're a band from California, you know, Torrance to be exact, kind of playing pop punk, but not in the sense that, like, it sounds like Blink-182. It's not in the sense that it was, like, where it's like Blink-182 or like Sum 41 or whatever. It has its roots more like in, like, you know, maybe early Green Day, or, you know, and they name drop like Guided by Voices and, you know, Low as influences. And it's just music that's very compact and very hooky, but it has this like kind of intelligence and eeriness that sets them apart, I think, from, you know, most pop punk. You know, you would never imagine them being on like a label like Rise or Hopeless, where you know, you're talking about bands like Real Friends or like All Time Low. You know, the thing that really helped them was their first record was produced, or no, their second record was produced by Jack Shirley, a guy who ended up producing Sunbather, which I believe we'll be talking about. Two completely different records, but like, once you got like Joyce Manor being like, you know, oh, they were produced by Def Heaven's producer, and then they signed to Epitaph, you know, they were given like a certain legitimacy and platform they didn't have before. And, you know, by the time they put out their best record, which, you know, you can get arguments about that, like, they already had accumulated this really fervent fan base, with, you know, a reputation for really awesome live shows. And, you know, that's really one of the cool things about, you know, kind of seeing this world of, like, you know, fans who play Fest. You know, by the time that they're on the radar of most bigger publications, it's not like a guessing game, like, you know, with Title Fight as well. Like, these people, like, they already have fans. They already have a fan base, and they are, you know, you don't have to worry about whether or not they'll have legs. This record is just, it's like 10 songs, 18 minutes. Like, everyone is just, it's just so well written, and you know, I can listen to it like twice in a row, which is not something I can say about like basically any record. I think it's going to be like a record that people really talk about, like as being, yeah, I really loved that record back in the day.
Yeah,
or whatever.
I mean, yeah, I think, yeah, again, we're talking about Never Hung Over Again by Joyce Manor, came out in 2014, and I definitely look at this band as a band that is on the rise, that has potential to have a pretty big audience, I think, and they're on Epitaph Records, so they're going to have...
Yeah, they could be like a new super chunk or like, you know, a jawbreaker for that matter.
Right.
Like, that's,
I mean,
what I see they're kind of feeling as.
Right, yeah, and I kind of put them in like a promise ring, you know, category as well, you know, so like a melodic, pretty, like, punk emo type band. Really great stuff. Mm-hmm. So my number 10 record, and you just mentioned it, is Sunbather by the San Francisco black metal band.
They're in L.A. now.
They're in L.A. now. Okay, well, they were in the Bay Area when they made this record. And this record came out in 2013. And Def Heaven, they get called a black metal band, but if you listen to Sunbather, it's not going to sound to you necessarily like a black metal record. The vocals are very growly and intense.
Yeah.
Kind of have that thing going on. But musically, it owes just as much to like shoegaze music from the early 90s. There's like a U2 element to their to their records, very epic sounding. And it's just simply like one of the most beautiful records that I've heard so far this decade, not just rock records, but of any genre.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, the songs are very long. You know, this is a, you mentioned the connection between this record and Never Hung Over Again, whereas Never Hung Over Again, you know, it's 10 songs, 18 minutes. You know, there's like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Song, exactly. 10 minute songs.
He produced the second Joyce Manor record, which like is shorter. It was like 9 songs, and like some of the songs on Sunday that are longer than that Joyce Manor album that's actually produced.
So it, you know, it's a beautiful record. The songs are beautiful. There's a lot of melody in the songs, but it's as much about atmosphere and texture on this record. The highs and lows between, you know, just the intense catharsis of the vocals in contrast with, you know, just this incredible sort of surging music. That's really great. And I know this is on your list too. This was actually, is this number 7 on your list?
Yeah, it's number 7 on mine. But really, what I think Def Heaven's indicative of is just, I feel that when a band like Def Heaven, who otherwise wouldn't be, you know, most people, I can certainly say I'm not checking for metal like a lot of times. And, you know, when there are other metal records, you know, like you look at like Windhand or Yob or like some of the bands that like Def Heaven might tour with, like why that hasn't, why it hasn't stuck for me the way Sunbather has. I mean, yeah, you can look at the fact that it's like a metal record with very, very distinct, you know, like whether like indie rock or like, you know, it's a new album, they talk about like incorporating like Low and like Red House Painters in there. But, you know, I think they're kind of proof that like if the press or like, you know, the music writing community gets behind a certain rock band and like lets people know that like, hey, this is like, I think, you know, that can have an effect like on bands, you know, like I think it's like the equivalent of like having like a song that actually gets on MTV. Like, I mean, like when you go to a Def Heaven show, it's not like a metal audience. I mean, there is that element there, but,
well, and I think what's great about Def Heaven, I mean, and they get criticized in the metal community because they're not flying the flag necessarily for like metal the way a lot of metal bands tend to.
They are in their way, but musically they're not. Like,
right.
Perceived audience argument. Like, that's really always what it comes down to, isn't it?
But I think like another, you know, like another trend this decade, you know, when we're talking about, you know, sort of the innovative, exciting rock bands is that there's some of the most experimental bands have come out of the metal scene, you know, and not just experimental, but also bands that if you're looking for that sort of like 90s alt rock, you know, anthemic quality, they're also in that area too, in the way that they were back then, you know, that Soundgarden and Alice in Chains, those bands were alt metal bands before they were grunge bands and mainstream rock bands. But, you know, I would certainly group in like Baroness in there and Torch and even Latter Day Mastodon.
Have
made really good sort of like, you know, really good kind of straight up rock records.
Yeah, but I would say Def Heaven like doesn't quite go like.
No, they're not making straight ahead rock records.
No, they're not, and I think that's why they're kind of. You can still like feel sort of, you know, like okay, saying like, yeah, this is like more, you know, it's not as like straight up as, you know, like a Mastodon record, which I don't think like they're way bigger, like. You know, Mastodon is where as far as fan base goes, but like Def Heaven, like that's like the sort of band to be like the one metal band people listen to, and I think that they're a crossover band. And I think that's extremely important, and that's why I find Sunbather to be like such an important record.
Right.
Whether it got people into other metal bands, I don't know, but it allowed people to, I think it just allowed people to, you know, see that, you know, what, I think it's like a rising, a tide lifts all boats sort of thing with Death Heaven in their world.
So let's move on to number nine, and we're going to, I'm going to try to move us along a little bit until we get to the end, because the records at the top will probably want to pontificate on for a while.
Right.
So we'll breeze through some of these earlier entries, although these are all awesome records, and
yeah.
I definitely stand by all my choices. My number nine record of the 2010s, of the Audis, is Southeastern by Jason Isbell, which came out in 2013. And I put this record on my list because I think in terms of songwriting, what we traditionally talk about in terms of songwriters, you know, if we're talking about like the rock continuum of singer-songwriters going back to the 70s, you know, with Neil Young, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, Jason Isbell is the best example of that working right now. And Southeastern, to me, is sort of the quintessential version of that record to come out this decade. You know, when I was making my list of 10 records, one of my qualifications was, does this record give me the chills at any moment in the record? And that's true of Southeastern for me on the song Elephant, which is for me maybe the greatest, one of the greatest songs of the decade so far, certainly the biggest tearjerker.
Yeah,
a song about a man and a woman meet each other. The woman is dying of cancer. The man is trying to kind of ease her pain as she is dying. And I know when I say that out loud, it sounds incredibly sappy and sentimental. But the way that the song is written and delivered, it's just an incredible amount of craft. Again, if that's something that you're looking for right now, I would definitely recommend that. As far as this decade,
I think there's like a parallel to what I put at number eight. If we're gonna the record I put at number eight, Benji by Sun Kyung Moon, gives me the same effect. Like
before you talk about that, I just want to mention your number nine record was Attack on Memory, Cloud Nothings, which is a great record. Sort of a pulverizing type, you know, like Nirvana working with Steve Albini type record. Awesome.
Just a quick thing on that. It's like, it's funny. Like when you really listen to it, it's like a lot of it sounds like a Get Up Kids record produced by like Steve Albini, which is awesome to me. Like, and I think that's not to like, you know, take like say, oh, they're really like an emo band disguised. They're probably not. Like they present more as like a punk band. But I think what that record does is, you know, give you, like a lot of bands like try to, you know, get that Albini sound, whether it be like Nirvana or, you know, Jesus Lizard or whatever. But, you know, Cloud Nothings, what they did is like they started as like a pop band and then they got like heavier and harder, which is usually the opposite. And like on Attack on Memory, it's like you have that like really vicious assault and they have the best drummer, I think, in indie rock right now. But they still have that like pop element that, you know, like these songs are actually catchy, whereas that's like really fucking hard to do. So
and I think they're another example of a band that's like evolved on record, and there are a lot, you know, because there are, you know, there's a whole kind of a clatch of young bands, like people that started writing and putting out records like when they were 18, 19 years old.
Yeah,
and it's really interesting to see how quickly they evolve, and Cloud Nothings was an example of that, going from sort of, you know, lo-fi, almost twee-sounding indie pop songs, going into this, like, really aggressive, you know, punk rock records with, like, a fat bottom end and, like, long discursive, you know, sections in the middle of songs, you know, blowing them up to 7-8 minutes long, but really exciting stuff. But now that we got that out of the way, though, I want to hear you talk about Benji by Sun Kyung Moon, your number eight record. I just made an argument for Southeastern by Jason Isbell being sort of like the great sort of singer songwriter rock record of the decade so far, but for you, you're going to argue for Benji.
There's absolutely nothing like this record. I think it'll be interesting to see as, you know, things go forward. As far as like Sun Kyung Moon goes, like he's made like a fucking classic through three straight decades. I think Ghost of the Great Highway is a very different record than
that's my favorite still by him.
Yeah.
I think Ghost of the Great Highway.
Yeah, I think that gives me like a completely different thing than, you know, Red House Painter's album. But like Benji, it remains to be seen whether once this whole thing with Mark Kozlik dies down and, like, you know, the outrage and such, whether that will mean that people will recognize, feel the way they did about it when it first came out, before they, like, you know, found out that, like, wait, this guy's been kind of a dick all his life.
You know what? I have a crystal ball in front of me, and you know what it says?
What's that?
It says that it will not make a difference, this controversy, that the records will live on. I mean, if Leonard...
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Like, I think...
It won't make a difference. I mean, if Twitter existed, like, when Leonard Cohen was putting out, like, Death of a Ladies Man or something, I mean...
Or Serge Gainsbourg, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, people would have been going crazy. But, you know, that stuff fades away, and what's left is the art. And, like, he writes incredible songs, no matter what he's like as a person. He seems like kind of... You know, a monstrous person in a lot of ways, or at least not a great guy you want to be, you know, having coffee with necessarily.
Or just maybe you would. It sounds interesting to me. I mean,
that's true.
But I would think with that record, what it just, there's absolutely nothing like it. Like, I cannot think of a record. Like, when I just remember when I heard it for the first time, it was a scream. And, you know, he had been kind of going that route on like a previous record, which, I mean, he made a song called, like, it's about, like, being, like, on the same stage with, like, an attractive but not talented woman. And, like, I mean, he got away with that because, like, no one had really paid attention to him. But, yeah, I mean, when I first heard Benji, like, I just emailed, like, my editor, like, are we hearing the same fucking thing? Like, this is, like, I've never heard anyone just, like, put, like, just be this, like, honest and, like, straightforward, but, like, have the subject matter. I mean, like, it's such a hard record to recreate. Like, it just stands alone as this, I don't know,
it's
a way that it's just impossible to recreate.
It's gut-wrenching and hilarious, like, sometimes in the same lyric.
Like, I just could not believe, like, it's one of the few records where I just could not believe what I was hearing.
And, you know, the thing about Kozlik, too, is that as much as he irritates me at times, you know, when he's giving interviews, is that I appreciate a guy who, like, does not give a shit, right?
Now,
you know what I mean? Like, he's clearly not a guy that has anyone whispering in his ear saying, hey, man, this is not going to go over well on Twitter if you do this.
He's got his own label. He tours by himself for the most part. I mean, like, he's really as DIY as you could get. I mean, like, so it's interesting that, like, you know, he has, like, total autonomy in a way, but, you know, it works against him in certain ways, but, you know, whatever. It'll be interesting. I'm seeing him next month, and I'm very much looking forward to that.
It should be good. One band that I'm seeing next week, although by the time this airs, I will have seen them like a month in the past, so I'll pretend that I just saw them. But my number 8 record is Halcyon Digest by Deer Hunter. And, you know, we brought them up earlier, Deer Hunter, as being sort of the epitome of, like, what we would traditionally define as an indie rock band.
You know,
and they come out of that sort of 2000s, you know, bumper crop of indie bands. You could argue that in a way they peaked in the late 2000s when they put out Microcastle, which I think is probably still their best record for me. Either that or Halcyon Digest. But, like,
I think Halcyon Digest is going to be the one. Like, that's the one.
You know, Microcastle has, like, Nothing Ever Happened. And I don't know. Both of those
but
records
I think
are great.
Halcyon Digest put them on, like, a much, much bigger stage.
It's their pop record, I think. It's definitely the closest they came to being sort of like, you know, like that kind of mainstream rock band. I mean, that's as close as they're ever going to get. And it's interesting to see how, you know, what Bradford Cox, who's the frontman of Deer Hunter, you know, how he has steered them since this record. Because, you know, this is, Halcyon Digest is this beautiful, very well produced, sort of lush record with really great pop songs on it. And then since then, he's sort of taken them on a bit wilder direction, I guess. Like, their next record was Monomania, which was a very sort of confrontational, punky type record. Still very catchy in a lot of ways. A lot of great songs on there. And then their latest record, Fading Frontier, which is a record I like, came out here in 2015. It seems a little slight to me. It has not stuck with me the way other Deer Hunter records have.
It's a good record. You know, Deer Hunter, I think, to me...
It feels like a last record to me. I wonder if Deer Hunter is done after this, because even the title suggests that they're done. It just reminds me a little bit of that last Pavement record, Terror Twilight.
Oh, yeah.
Starting with the title and also just the mood of it. It's like... there's a certain amount of contentment on that record.
Yeah.
Musically, it's pleasant, but it's not necessarily a grabber type record. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to know.
Interesting. I think Deer Hunter going like Deer Hunter is like the last of its kind in a weird way. Like they're like a band that is kind of a 90s style indie rock band, where but they couldn't exist like and not in the 2000s. I mean, like to me, they're like a catalog band, and they're clearly like an indie rock band. Like there's no other way to slice it. And yeah, I mean, like I think that Bradford Cox will always make music. I don't know what the fuck else he would do. But yeah, I think this one, they're in their like kind of cruising altitude phase right now. I think like Halcyon Digest is like their answer to, I don't know, like whether it's like Crooked Rain or like B-1000 or whatever, where like afterwards, it's like they or like or like with Viola Tango, for example, it's like I can hear the heart beating is one. Like after that, it's just like none of the records are ever a huge deal, but they always get like well received from like older rock critics, and but none of them ever like can really galvanize the conversation the way Halcyon Digest would. I'd say
Yeah.
they're kind of in cruising altitude.
It is fascinating to see like how quickly things change because Deer Hunter already seems like a band. They seem like the Paul Simon of like indie rock in a way. Like like how like certain rock critics will like put the Paul Simon record on their best of list because they love Paul
Yeah,
Simon
he's
and they
always at
respect
like
him.
number 25 for me or
Right. And like
something.
I feel like Deer Hunter for people who are like, between the ages of like, if you're a music writer between the ages of like say 31, 32 to like 37. They're always going to have that kind of significance, whereas if you're in your 20s, I don't know if they have that, but it's an interesting
Yeah, I think they would,
discussion.
because if you were like a teenager having grown up like checking for indie rock, I mean, like Deer Hunter's the band that like you're told like it's like yeah, this is like what's happening. So I think there'll be like Wolf Parade, for example, like people fucking love Wolf Parade, but yeah, I think you're right in that sense where they're like at that Yola Tango or like Steve Malcolm solo album point of their career.
So we're moving on to number seven now. We're going to keep us moving here. Your number seven record was Sunbather by Deaf Heaven, which
Yeah.
we've already covered. My number seven record is Transgender Dysphoria Blues by Against Me. And this record, it's funny because this record has the production of like a mid-period Green Day record. And a lot of the songs on the record I think are really catchy and could have been on the radio. And yet this album is still somewhat, I think, it did really well with critics. I think Against Me has their fans, because Against Me went through a period in the 2000s, like where they flirted with sort of mainstream stardom. They put out that record in 2007, New Wave, which had some radio hits off of it. But then they sort of backed off from that. And then, the big narrative with Transgender Dysphoria Blues is that the front woman of the band, Laura Jane Grace, came out as transgender, and a lot of the songs address that on the record. So, for that alone, this is an utterly unique and historic rock record to come out this decade. But for me, what really pushes it over the top is that the songwriting and the performances are just really thrilling. And I think as a rock record, like if you're looking for just sort of like a catchy, anthemic, but also an album with some angry edge to it. It really is the finest example of that kind of rock record to come out this decade. And I know like you like Against Me, but you're sort of
I'm on the fence
on the
because, like,
fence.
I think as you know, I think there are certain aspects of it that, it's a very compelling story. I think some of the songs are a little bit, and it's tough to say, like, that's a little like too blunt, or it's like because, like, I mean, it's supposed to be like a very blunt record, but as like a listening experience, like, I think if it just had like more, like, I don't know, I don't like the production of it very much. I think it's like very, very flat. The peaks are incredible, but I mean, I think it's just like such a socially significant fucking record, that it's like almost critic proof in a way. Like
Right.
I appreciate, like, I'm like happy that this record exists and it'll be a force for good going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, even before you put the record on, you know that this is like one of the most significant rock records to come out this decade, just because of the backstory. But for me, I disagree on the production. Like, I like that sort of glossy production style, and you know, and to me, it adds a welcome contrast to the anger in the songs. I guess I'm always a sucker for the sugar and spice combination. Mm-hmm. You know, a song that is really angry but externally is so poppy and catchy that you can't help but love it. But then you actually like listen to the lyrics and you see how much heaviness is going on in the space of the song. I mean, that's a winning combination no matter who's doing it, and it's particularly effective on that record, I think. And it's, you know, it's a half hour long, so it kind of comes and goes. And I mean, the first time I got that record, I listened to it like 3 or 4 times in a row because it just was like candy to me. You know, just from a sonic point of view. And then, you know, and that in combination with just, you know, Laura Jane Grace's amazing lyrics, it's a pretty heady combination. We're moving on to our number six record. Records. My number six record will be familiar to listeners of this podcast because it's the name of this podcast, Celebration Rock by Japan Droids. And we're not going to talk about this record right now because I have a feeling we will be talking about it later. So why don't we put a hold on the Japan Droids conversation, and we'll talk about your number six record, which is another band that a lot of people probably haven't heard of, but is one of the great sort of young bands, American rock bands right now, which is Cymbals Eat Guitars and their 2014 record, Lose.
Yeah, this one to me is just, I mean, this when I first heard of it, like I was describing it to people, like as the way you would describe like Mike Trout or whatever. This is just like such a... It's like toolsy, you know. It's got like, you know, the lyrics are just like so deep and like referential in a way that like you would expect maybe out of like Vampire Weekend or whatever. Like it's very, very well beholden to, you know, like annotation. But they have, you know, the guitar playing is just like really phenomenal as well. It's like one of the few records that where like the guitar playing is like very creative, and there are solos that, you know, there are like actual solos and like actual riffs, but like not in the way where it's like, you know, metal or whatever. And, you know, the rhythm section as well, like there's just like such punch, and like the production is great. As you know, the same guy who produces like Kurt Vile records. And you know, just the story behind it, of, like, you know, their previous two records, like the first one that came out in 2009, I guess at the height, their first record was like kind of like the last bow of like, you know, finding bands on MySpace. They were discovered off MySpace, you know, for the most part. And, you know, that was very referential of like Modest Mouse and like Built to Spill, which was still kind of novel in 2009 when you look at the overall picture. And then in 2011, they made a record that was like very, very dense and like almost like Cap'n Jazz-esque, like very lyrically nice. And the band has sort of disowned it to a degree because they said it's like too complicated. So when this record, Lose, came out, like, I wasn't expecting very much, to be honest with you. I don't think people were as well, which is why I think it didn't quite get the attention that it could have. Like, if they were a new band, I think they'd be all right. But, like, when I talk to people about the record, they're considered, like, a CMJ band, which is, they, like, kind of a, they get spoke up in the past tense as, like, you know, oh, they're just, like, a 2009 band or whatever. But, I mean, I just... God, this record is like un-fucking peachable to me.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's just an example of a record that doesn't slot comfortably in any genre, and yet it ends up being great for the reasons that record should be great, which is that the lyrics are you know, really well conceived, and they're sophisticated in a way, but also they're very, you know, they're drawing on very direct emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of sorrow on this record. There's a lot of, but there's also a lot of hope on the record. But there's interconnected narratives going on. It's very sophisticated. So you have that going for it. You know, the musically again, there's a lot of sophistication going on. You know, there, like you said, there's metal influences. There's prog influences, but at the same time, they're writing great straight up rock songs. And when you hear them the first time, they register as great straightforward rock songs. And then it's only after you listen to them a couple times you start to maybe really appreciate sort of the intricate nature of the songwriting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just an album that I think works on an immediate level, and yet, you know, it's a real meal. There's a lot there to digest.
Yeah. I think with them, it's like what we talk about is where they're, you know, Joe, the lead singer of the band itself, has said it to me, you know, it's like they're too, right now, they're like too, you know, they're too indie for emo, but too emo for indie or whatever. And, like, you know, they started touring with bands like Brand New and Modern Baseball. And I think that's, you know, a pretty wise decision on there, and to recognize that's, like, where people who would be into this record are, you know. It's like, this is a record that might have been, like, you know, more... it's like a 2005 style record, but it's out in 2014, and you know the real, like, you know, the narrative didn't really swing their way. But right. It'll be interesting to see what happens with their next records. I think Lose got like a lot of unexpected, like late blooming goodwill, so now they're on a new label.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be a record that people discover too over the next like year or two or three, and it's going to have legs, I think.
People need to fight for that one.
moving on to our number five choices, your number five choice was Lonerism by Tame Impala. We're going to hold that one because that's going to be coming up again later. My number five record is Waking on a Pretty Days by Kurt Vile. And for those who don't know who Kurt Vile is, he is really the closest thing that we have right now to like a Tom Petty, a guy who is writing really catchy rock songs, doing it from sort of like a regular guy perspective. On Waking on a Pretty Days, you know, the earlier Kurt Vile records were much more sort of folk influenced, sort of like a spooky late night folk sound. This record is much more of like a California-type record. The songs are opened up. They're much longer. There's a lot more guitar solos on this record.
Yeah.
And, you know, usually, you know, guitar solos now, you know, they do seem like an anachronism in a lot of ways. You know, the idea of the guitar hero has been outmoded. But this is the record that will restore your faith in guitar solos. I swear to goodness. It is like a great... example of that kind of record that you don't really hear that much anymore. And if I were to rank my top 10 just purely on the number of times I've played each record, the Vile record would probably be my number one. When I was writing my book, this was one of the albums that I played the most. So Kurt Vile actually gets a shout out in my book because he was an important inspiration for writing it. But I know you are not really a Kurt Vile fan.
I am a Kurt Vile fan. As a matter of fact, like, Waking on a Pretty Day, like, Smoke Rings...
Because you've talked smack. You've talked some smack about Kurt Vile, though.
But the new record, I think, the new record is where I think he's kind of play-acting in a way that I find to be very, I don't know, I think, like, it's purposefully sort of cynical, but, like, it doesn't register. I mean, I love Smoke Rings for My Halo. That would probably be my go-to. You know, Waking on a Pretty Days, I'll ride for that record as well. But, like, just the new one, it just seems like, I don't know. It sounds like Kurt Vile. Like, it sounds like someone playing Kurt Vile, you know?
Oh, man. I could not disagree with you more. I don't like it as much as Waking on a Pretty Days or Smoke Ring for My Halo. I think both of those records are really great. Are a cut above like most records that have come out, you know, in the last 5-6 years.
But I think it's just indicative to me more, or it's just like this sort of build up of like, I don't know, just my personal resentment towards like the only allowable rock being like coming from like a chill bro perspective, such as like Real Estate or like Mac DeMarco or like, and yeah, so I mean like Kurt Vile gets kind of caught out. He just picked a bad time. Release a record I really don't like, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, Kurt Vile, you know, unlike a band like Joyce Manor or even Simple Z Guitars, maybe doesn't have the same kind of audience where, like the 14-year-old kid is not necessarily going to glom onto a guy like Kurt Vile who is clearly, you know, descended from, like, Neil Young, Bruce Springsteen, that sort of classic rock tradition. That he's,
yeah.
I mean, Kurt Vile doesn't even really identify as an indie rock person at all. He's definitely more in the classic rock continuum. So, not necessarily doesn't have the same sort of like, you know, kids coming out to the shows necessarily. But I don't know, for the kind of records he's making, and that record in particular, I think, is great and seems to be a record that I feel like I'm going to be listening to that record for a long time.
Yeah, I will as well.
Going to number four, my number four record is Lonerism by Tame Impala, which was your number five. So we both have it at around the same point on our list.
Yeah.
Why did you put it on your list?
I think with like they're one of the bands that will be seen as like the 2010s. Like, I mean, just being like one of the bedrock sort of bands. Like if you were around in like the 2010s, like an engaged music band, like Tame Impala was like, I mean, all the their first three records, I mean, are just, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of Interspeaker, but they're building such like a, like such an awesome discography. And if I were to pick, but like Lonerism to me, I think that's going to be the one going forward. Like in the same way how, I mean, Current, I fucking love that record, but I think when the time comes to like, you know, make the 2010 list and such, I think Lonerism is going to be the one that like ranks the highest. And to me, it's the most consistent. It's the one that is just, I just love the production on it. And the songs, I think, you know, I think Current has stronger singles. Like, I think The Moment and, like, Let It Happen and such, like, are just such peaks for Kevin Parker. But Lonerism just, I don't know, it feels more whole.
Yeah, and for me, there's like, a stronger sort of emotional payoff on Lonerism. Like, you know, when we talk about Tame Impala, you know, they kind of come out of that psychedelic, you know, I don't want to say garage rock, but you know, there's this whole sort of generation.
When they first came out, people thought they were like kind of like MGMT or something.
Right. I mean, and there's like a whole sort of like subgenre of bands who are like that, who are very 60s influenced, and you know, they have like sitars on their records and stuff like that, and it's kind of druggy and all that stuff. And they tend to appeal to a very sort of small number of people. And Tame Impala is the exception in that. In large part, I think, due to Kevin Parker just being a really great songwriter. I mean, he writes really great pop songs. And, I mean, there's been an evolution on their records from, you know, Interspeaker, which is a pretty straightforward example of, like, a psych pop record, to Currents that came out in 2015, which is really not psychedelic at all, doesn't have any of those trappings, really, and is really just sort of like a straightforward pop record. I mean, the cover of it is sort of psychedelic. But other than that, he's working in almost like the sort of indie R&B vein that like a lot of indie rock groups have moved toward this decade. That's his version of that kind of record.
Yeah, I think the difference between Tame Impala and like a lot of the bands that would, you know, would be considered like psych rock or whatever, or like even like Pie Steagall or like that garage rock thing, that they've always embraced like this really, you know, Dave Friedman production. It just sounds like it sounds big. Like that goes to like what we were first discussing, where it's like, you know, like to me, like Ty Segall or like Woods or like bands that ilk, you know, their records sound like small, whereas Tame Impala is like, you know, this is like, it sounds like a record I would pay money for.
Well, yeah. And he's making, he's a record maker, you know, and he definitely thinks in those terms. I mean, there's a reason why, and I cannot remember who, Mark Ronson. Thank you. I spaced on Mark Ronson's name for a second. There's a reason why he had Kevin Parker on his last album. You know, Mark Ronson, of course, is a big pop producer, worked with Amy Winehouse. You know, he did Uptown Funk with Bruno Mars. And he's working with Kevin Parker because he can recognize that this guy knows how to make records in a way that maybe a lot of other people from the indie realm don't. And I think Lonerism, it does feel like, as you said before, that it's going to be one of the sort of the canonical records of this.
Yeah.
It's going to be like one of the four or five that people always mention. And
It has such a broad appeal because, like, you know, if you want to, like, get on that shit where you're just, you know, you're kind of, like, really into, like, psych rock and, like, you know, very, very, like, value-based, like, you know, old school, like, it has that. But it has, like, that kind of modernist production with Dave Friedman and, like, but it's also kind of indie rock in a way where, you know, they aren't, I mean, it just like hits all targets, you know?
Right. Your number four record is Home Like No Place Is There by The Hotel Year. That's an impossible title to say out loud.
Oh God. It's like, you know, I passed on that record when I was first given to me. Cause I'm like, oh God, like, you know, that title, but, man, you want to talk about a record that's going to, like, really be important to people going forward. I mean, it just won't be, like, you know, and just kind of give a little bit of background on The Hotel Year. The Hotel Year is a band that is, I think, you know, I could say definitively they're named after an Ataris song, the Ataris being, like, kind of indicative of the, you know, what emo or, like, pop punk was considered in, like, their late, you know, the early 2000s to mid 2000s, is kind of its own hair metal phase. But, you know, they came out of fucking nowhere in 2014. Like, you know, the whole emo revival thing was like kind of, you know, being bandied about towards the end of 2013. And, you know, there were some good, like, bands who were still making incredible records, one which maybe we'll discuss later. But, you know, when that record just kind of came, like, I mean, it's sort of like Lose in a way where the narrative behind it, you know, I'm big on records that are mostly around people dying. and, you know, it just, the aggression, but like the song, like with most emo records that come out, it was like based more in, you know, American football or like Cap and Jazz, like more obtuse stuff. Whereas this is like, it reminded me of like the Thermals or like early Titus Andronicus. And, you know, the vocals, which were a stumbling point for people, you know, they were like, I don't know, like the weaker ends or whatever, or even piebald. And this record just like hit me. Like, I started working in treatment in 2014 with people with, you know, certain sort of disorders and, you know, illnesses and addictions and such. And, you know, that's what this record is for the most part about. And just it's really just, you don't expect this sort of ambition or like sequencing or like melodicism from bands of this ilk. Like, I mean, it's just like, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing, that it was like this band who three years ago, they were like, you know, they were a pretty straightforward pop punk band, like making this kind of leap. It was hard to believe. And it was really awesome throughout the year to see people, you know, by the end of the year, they were being mentioned in like the New Yorker and like, you know, things like that. So, I mean, I think that's
definitely like a grassroots thing too. I mean, there was not like some orchestrated, you know, PR campaign with that.
No,
it was definitely
not.
Just people, you know, who heard the record and loved it and, you know, preach about it. And that's how it catches on. And that's always a great thing when you can see that still happen.
Their PR / record label is like a dude in South Carolina. Like, And their next record will be on the same label. So, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens when, you know, people come through expecting that sort of thing. But, man, that record does things to people. I think it'll have the sort of reputation in 10 years or so where it's like, oh, there are bands like some like Sunny Day Real Estate or Brand New or Mineral or whatever. But, gosh, that record really just, that was such an awesome thing to see happen in 2014.
Well, and what you're going to see on both of our lists from here on out are bands who are, in many cases, operating on like a basement show budget, but are aspiring to the uplift and emotional payoffs of like stadium rock. So that's going to be a recurring theme, I think, for the rest of our list. My number three record is a band you might have heard of called Arcade Fire.
Yeah.
And the record is The Suburbs. And Ian, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with this band.
I do too.
I go back and forth with this band. I hated their last record, Reflector, which to me has all the hallmarks of a band that has escaped inside of its own ass, basically. Just been swallowed up by its own megalomania, where you have a concept that's unwieldy, you have songs that are way too long, and you have way too many songs, you know, that don't work. But at the same time, Arcade Fire, when they work, when their albums work, when their songs work, they deliver what I'm looking for from a rock record, which again is
not agree more.
Which is that sort of sweeping uplift. And The Suburbs to me is a great example of that. The Suburbs does have some of the hallmarks of what I don't like about Arcade Fire. It is a bloated record. There are too many songs on it. I think, but at its core, it really speaks to me. Not, you know, because thematically it talks a lot about how, you know, like when you're growing up, you end up turning to music in order to define yourself.
Yeah,
and you use bands to not only, you know, say who you are, but you use it to set yourself apart from other people, and how that can be sort of a galvanizing thing, but it also separates people. And that really spoke to me, I guess, you know, spoke to my own experiences growing up. And I think it also says something about rock music in a larger way, because rock music itself is so, you know, so segmented right now.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I'd say about The Suburbs too, is that it's probably, out of all the records on both of our lists, it's the one record that seems the most culturally important. You know,
yeah.
It's the closest thing that this decade has, I think, to a Joshua Tree, in the sense that it sold a lot of records. It won, you know, the Grammy for Album of the Year. You know, it made an impact in a way that a lot of rock records didn't. And Arcade Fire, in a way, this almost feels like a 2000s record, more than a 2010s, because it was like a payoff for Funeral and Neon Bible and sort of the rise that they went on during that decade. And then they put out this record at the beginning of this decade, and it was sort of the culmination of what they were trying to do. And now they've, in my mind, they've stumbled since. A lot of people love Reflector. A lot of people would disagree with me, I'm sure. But I know this wasn't on your list, but I mean, are you a fan?
I love that. So The Suburbs is a record that I really, I like that record a lot. I wrote about it in 2010 when that record, The Suburbs, in a way that, like, I mean, Funeral is like one of my probably five favorite records of all time. I mean, that is like what I want out of music. And I think a lot of the records on my list, like, kind of get that same sort of like kind of sort of raw but sweeping, like, sort of thing, where it's like they want a bigger audience, but like they're not chasing after it in a way. But I think The Suburbs hits me in like a much more direct and somewhat in a more embarrassing place. I mean, you look at a song like Ready to Start, the lyrics, like, you know, about like the emperor, the emperor has no clothes, and like all things like that. It's like it just hits me in a very direct, but like they just hit with such blunt force in such an embarrassing way that it just, like, bowls you over. Like, the Arcade Fire is, you know, they're the only band to come out of, like, what I would say, like, indie rock in, you know, the 2000s who can headline a day of Coachella.
Right.
Which, you know, is responsible for the best parts of their music and responsible for the worst parts of their music.
Right. And to me, that's always the most important thing about them that is the trait that they share with U2, in that their willingness to overreach is maddening sometimes, but it's also thrilling, you know?
Yeah. Like, who the fuck else does it? I mean, like, there's nobody, like, who are their competition, you know?
And as much as I've criticized Reflector, there is a way in that I am sort of grateful that they are willing to make that kind of record. You know, that they were trying to make a masterpiece with that, and I think they fell really short. But the fact that there's a band that is willing to embarrass itself to the degree that they are willing to do that, I think is commendable. And there are precious few bands that are able to do that, like, they have the means to do that, they are popular enough to do that, or the courage, you know, to just to embrace jackassery as much as Arcade Fire does, because again, when it pays off, when you take those big swings, it really is, it can be incredible, and I think The Suburbs is one of the best examples of that. Your number three record is The Monitor by Titus Andronicus. And we're going to be talking about that very shortly, so let's pause on that conversation. So let's talk about your number two record, and this is hot off the presses.
Yeah, very much so.
This is a 2015 record.
Yeah.
The World is a Beautiful Place. This band...
I'm no longer afraid to die.
Yeah, I can never get their entire band name correct. Harmlessness. Mm-hmm. And this is your number two record already. And
yeah,
I know you are you are a huge acolyte for this band and this record.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's amongst people who take bands of their ilk seriously, and I think you can group like the Hotel Urine and Joyce Banner in there as well. Title Fight being an example, you know, Foxing, Days of Purse, like, you know, that whole Run for Cover, like Top Shelf, even Epitaph and Anti, you can throw them in there as well. That like gap that exists between like K-Rock/Warped Tour and, you know, what you would consider like proper indie rock, that space, which people have been describing in some ways like emo revival or whatever. Like, I think it's always been building to some sort of statement. It's like where, like, you know, it's produced great bands, but like you haven't really always gotten that sort of record where it's just unimpeachable. And God, Harmlessness, like, I can't even listen to their first record, which was a top 20 record of the decade for me before Harmlessness dropped. And when I heard Harmlessness, you know, it just reminded me so much of, like, you know, classic indie rock of, like, 2005, where, like, we have, like, nine guys on all. They just go for it in a way that I think confuses or just is off-putting to people nowadays. And, you know, like, it was only reviewed by, like, a couple outlets, but, you know, some of the places that, like, don't really put scores on, like, you know, let's say, like, Absolute Punk or, like, Stereo Gum or whatever, like, people are saying, like, yeah, this is a fucking classic. It's like, if they're a band that doesn't really have a space in the current scheme of things, and I feel that's, like, why we're even doing this sort of podcast. It's like, you know, otherwise, like, there'd be no point in, like, doing, like, oh, best rock records. So, like, we'd be talking about, like, you know, it'd be the equivalent of, like, talking about, like, Drake or, like, Future or whatever, or, like, Taylor Swift. But the fact that, like, this album, like, just sort of falls on deaf ears is just a little mind-blowing to me. I think it's the sophistication of, like, the arrangements, like the lyrical content, the range, just the ambition, and the fact that they actually have a good fucking drum. I mean, that's another commonality, except with the exception of Benji. Like, drums play such an important role in what I consider, you know, to be a great record. Like, I think a lot of indie rock bands, like, kind of half-ass it on bass and drums, which is like half the band.
Right. Well, it's having that live seasoning. You know, like, bands that play live a lot, I think, tend to have better rhythm sections. And there's certain bands that, like, are more studio bands, I think, that, you know, they don't necessarily have the great rhythm section. I mean, this record is a record I like. I do not love it to the degree that you do. It didn't even make my year-end list.
I think you need, like, investment, like, to see them.
I think I would. I mean, as you know, like, my number one record of 2015 was Beach Slang.
Yeah.
Which is, like, you and I, you know, which they're both sort of in that sort of emo rock, you know, ghetto in a way.
But Beach Slang
is more of like a straightforward. It's more of like a straightforward rock and roll. Like, if you love
and
the Replacements,
right?
But I mean,
you want to talk about the connections,
but
yeah.
But, like, the commonality, I would say, is that, like, it's interesting when you read people write about these bands sometimes, because there's almost like a defensiveness sometimes that people have that it's hard to write about music that is so open, like rock music that is so openly earnest and emotional, mm-hmm. where it seems like people are almost waiting to be made fun of or something if you like these records too much. And there is something, I think, like, if you love these bands, part of the reason what's so galvanizing about them is just how unapologetic they are about, okay, this is, you know, we're putting it on the line, you know, we're going to be openly emotional about this, you know, we're not going to pussyfoot around anything on these records. And they're very artful in the way that they're presented, but, like, the communication style, there's an artlessness to it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think, with both those records, it's like, they want to play to as many people as possible. And, like, I think there are a lot of, like, you know, records that we wouldn't put on this list that are still just as open and earnestness is very, very much a quality that is in vogue right now. But, you know.
And it can be terrible. I mean, there are lots of terrible records that, you know, could use more guile, you know. You know,
I think these guys just kind of search for that, like, bigger audience, like, that in a way that, like, I think I don't know, like, you know, some of the stuff that you might hear on, like, you know, Exploding, like, you know, Krill or, like, you know, Pile or, like, some of the other bands, or, like, Alex G, for that matter, a record I like a lot, and that's really, I think, going to be an important one going forward, but it doesn't have that same sort of, like, you know, that too, that, like, where you would hear, like, a Wolf Parade record or, like, a Broken Social Scene record or, you know, Arcade Fire, like, Circa Funeral and think, like, wow, like, they just sound like they're ready to take on the entire world.
Right. So it's interesting that you, because in a way your number two record, it is playing off that Arcade Fire a little bit in terms of, like, the nine people on stage, you know, banging on instruments and, like, making a huge sound. My number two record kind of comes at it from a different angle. It's Lost in the Dream by The War on Drugs. And War on Drugs.
They got five guys on stage.
What's that?
They got, like, six guys on stage.
Yeah, that's true. When I first wrote about this record, when it came out in the spring of 2014, I actually mentioned Arcade Fire. And I felt like when I first heard Lost in the Dream, to me, it was like the real sequel to The Suburbs, more than Reflector was. That this was, like, the next sort of great anthemic rock record that has elements of, like, you know, sort of 80s stadium rock in it, and at the same time is very much sort of rooted in the present tense. It sounds like a record that, it sounds like the modern day version of what those records were, where it's almost like it's almost like Born in the USA has been deconstructed and reconstructed into something that is a little bit murkier and more personal, but it's like the version of like what that music can be now. And
I think War on Drugs to me is like more akin to like Tame Impala than Arcade Fire. Like,
well, in terms of being a studio construction on their records.
Yeah, and also like Arcade Fire has like a very, very like shout along, like, I don't know if the lyrics
to me, it was more about the emotional element of it.
Okay.
and like what I was responding to in the music, you know, because again, like, you know, I, out of the two of us, I am more of like the classic rock head.
Yes,
like, I grew up listening to classic rock, you know, Springsteen, U2, stuff like that. And that's still, I think, where a lot of what I respond to is based on that. Sometimes consciously, sometimes not. And the War on Drugs, along with the Suburbs, those records push those buttons for me better than any other records that came out like in the last, you know, however, you know, in this decade, you know, where it's, you know, guitar and synth driven songs that sort of start off small and build to these crescendos and these big kind of payoffs that are really strong. So, okay, we're finally to our number one records.
Have we even talked about The Monitor?
What's that?
Yeah, have we even talked about The Monitor?
Well, The Monitor was number three. You've just spoiled it. I was just going to say my number one record. Okay, well, Ian just spoiled it. My number one record is The Monitor by Titus Andronicus, which was your number three record.
Yeah.
And for me, the reason why this was my number one, and it's funny because I feel like when this record first came out, I really liked it, but it was like almost too much to digest. Like, it was hard for me to wrap my head around it. And it's only like as the years have gone on that it has continued to grow in my estimation. I think because I realize how utterly unique it is, not only in terms of rock, but even just in Titus Andronicus's discography, which has a lot of records I like, but they don't come together as well as it does on The Monitor. And, you know, Titus Andronicus, again, they're a band from New Jersey. And they're slotted as a punk band, but again, they have a lot of classic rock in them. The front man, Patrick Stickles, is a big fan of The Replacements. He's from New Jersey, so of course he loves Springsteen. And he draws on a lot of that stuff on The Monitor, which is this concept record about his childhood that also has parallels to the Civil War. And all the songs are really long. There's almost like a progginess to them a little bit.
Yeah.
But I feel like this album delivers everything I want from a rock record, in that it's abrasive. There are great hooks on it. You know, there's like a lot of guitar solos that go wildly out of control. You know, it works as both pop music and prog rock music. It's all over the map. And yet, you know, when we talked earlier about like the chill factor, like how many times do I get chills during an album? This album, I put it at number one because it gives me the chills at most, you know, there are several different points, more than any other point, more than any other record that came out this decade. This record beats them all in terms of the chill count, you know. Mm-hmm. And we could just talk about like No Future Part 3. That song alone, I think, has more chill moments on it than most albums do, you know, in their entirety. It was your number three record, so you obviously love it too.
I think with The Monitor, like, I can't think of, other than Japan Droids, like, when Titus Andronicus came out with The Area Grievances in 2008, like, I can't remember a time where I just knew more instantly, like, this is my kind of fucking band. You know, back in 2008, they were, like, compared most often to, like, Bright Eyes, which, you know, is a great way, that's a great entry point for me. It's very much, like lifted for, like, you know, that sort of just tyrannical scope. And when I first heard The Monitor, I was in my office, like, you know, it was like during the winter break, and I just couldn't believe a band like was able to like turn that to make that record in 2010 with such like production values and such like density in the lyrics, but at the same time, like, having it actually fucking rock and, like, have it be, like, just this wide open world where, you know, some of the lyrics are, like, you know, just so on point and heavily referential. Some of them are just, like, super blunt and, like, almost embarrassing. But, you know, I think the commonality between them and, like, a band like Japan Droids or, like, a, you know, even though they are come from completely different sonic standpoints, that, like, this is, like verge of embarrassing-type music. Like, it's just, there's nothing cool about Titus Andronicus. And, you know, I think they kind of, you know, this rediscovered that on the new record. Like, they're a band where you just, you know, there's no, like, pretense about, like, being cool, like, being on trend or whatever. And the Monitor is just such a complete experience. Like, I can't, like, I need to listen to the whole thing, and I need to, like, prepare my, I need to, like, you know, okay, put the dishes away, like, make sure I don't got shit to do for, like, the next hour.
Right. Well, and it has that thing that, again, like, when I think about my favorite records ever, it, mm-hmm. you know, they all have this thing where there's an intellectual element where, like, you mm-hmm. want to think about the record and you want to break it down and you want to study the lyrics and you want to figure out how the songs bleed into each other. And then at the same time, it works as pure sensation. Like, if you don't want to, if you just want to play something loud, it works on that level too. And I think that's a really tricky thing that not a lot of records do. And to me, this record achieves that better than any other rock record that I've heard this decade. Where, again, you just want to think about it and you want to talk about it with friends and you want to break it down. But at the same time, it's just pure emotion and pure sensation.
So it's like a record where I think it's like along the lines of, like, you know, where like Moon in Antarctica by Modest Mouse or like, you know, Neutral Milk Hotel, where it's like, you feel like the person who made it was just like on, like, they were just like, there's like divine intervention or something like that, where they just go, like, there's something like less than human about them in a weird way, where they just like tap into something that is completely like just out of the ordinary. And I think Patrick Stickles like was able to do that right there. He was just like such a, like, everything around that record just seems like so special to me. Like, I just can't conceive of it being like demos at some point.
Right. So your number one record.
Yeah. I'm sorry if we skipped ahead of that. I thought Monitor's your number two.
That's okay. That's okay. We are only just building to the number one record. It's not like anyone has any anticipation for it. So it's fine if you spoil it for everybody. Your number one record, to the surprise of absolutely nobody who knows you anyway, is Celebration Rock by Japan Droids. And this is your favorite album of all time, isn't it?
It's my favorite record ever made. If you really want to talk about, like, chill factor and, like, you know, like, look, I mean, I think a lot, I could tell you that, you know, maybe listening to, like, you know, OK Computer when I was, like, 17, like, I bought that record in Israel. Like, that was, like, a more, you know, life-changing experience. You know, maybe that was the same with, like, Equimini or, like, Kid A or, like, Funeral or whatever, but, like, as an adult who was, like, 32 years old when that thing came out, like, it is just a record that I want to listen, like, I will never get tired. Like, I can't listen to OK Computer anymore. Like, I can't listen to Equimini. Like, there's just so much received baggage about it. But, you know, with Celebration Rock, I mean, like, gosh, like, how more pure can you be about your intentions? Like, Japan Droid, to me, like, it's just, like, such a uncool record. Like, they're talking about, like, every single song about these, like, incredible high-stakes life and death, salvation or, like, damnation-type, you know, binaries. And, like, how every second you're alive, it can, like, have something extremely important happen to you. Like, going out to a show and, like, seeing an awesome rock concert or, you know, meeting, like, a man or a woman. It just gives this, like, burst of energy, which I just, it never, like, dilutes, no matter how many times I hear it. It's just the distillation of everything which I want out of, like, music, really. Other records on this one have more range or, like, you know, the lyrics are more clever or, you know, more sonic diversity. But, you know, just for the 35 minutes where that's on, I just, And it's not even like, you know, when I was talking about the monitor being like kind of superhuman, you never lose sight of it. It's like two guys. Like, you know, one
yeah, it's
guy,
very human.
Yeah.
So Celebration Rock, it sounds like two guys, you know, making a record, and it's very mortal in its way, but that's part of the power of it, that it's a very human record. I mean,
gave everything they could, just like, and no pretense, no designs on like being on trend or being cool. And the song is like all melody, all riffs, like all drum fills. Like,
right. To me, like Celebration Rock, this is sort of like the Pulp Fiction of rock records this decade. this was number six on my list, by the way. Like, and I say that because, you know, like Pulp Fiction comes out, and what that movie was it synthesized, you know, dozens of other, you know, crime films, like from, you know, like the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And it presented it in this new guise that was really exciting. And it not only, you know, made people love Quentin Tarantino, but it sort of reinvigorated people's interests in like crime genre films.
Yeah.
And I feel like Celebration Rock did that for like rock history, and that you listen to that record and you hear everything that's great about Born to Run, about Appetite for Destruction, about Let It Be by The Replacements, about like all these great rock records that are sort of like dusty relics. And, you know, Celebration Rock doesn't necessarily sound like all those records, but like it's inspired by those albums. It has the spirit of those albums, and it finds a way to present what those records did in a new guise that is exciting, that makes you love Japan Droids, but also, I think for a lot of people, it made them want to hear more rock and roll like that, like more sort of like what we were saying before, like basement budget stuff that aspires to the heavens, you know?
Yeah.
Like this sort of widescreen, you know, fun, exhilarating, like, you know, pulverizing type rock
music. Yeah, people hug each other and shit, like during...
Right.
But during those shows, and yeah, I think a fun story is when I was at Coachella when they played, and you know, someone had come up to me and just started talking like about like how he had come from Denver to Coachella to see Japan Droids, and like how excited he was, and like I was figuring, okay, maybe he knows that, like, you know, I've written. This guy did not know who I was. Like, he was just like so excited, he just had to tell somebody who was standing there, like how he had like driven down from like, you know, Denver, and how he had never seen Japan Droids before, and like this is going to, like, I mean, this is like a pretty common theme at the shows, where just, you know, people just kind of let out, I guess, or I don't know, whatever's like building up. It's not anger in a way. If there's like no anger, I think, in Japan Droids music, I think it's just like this sort of thing you don't find for the most part in rock music, or even like indie rock, or just whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's release. I think it's people finding something that they didn't think existed anymore, and it's like just joy that they can experience it again. And it's a combination of the music and also the community that you discover when you get into a record like that.
And I think what's the cool thing about like this one is that unlike the Monitor, unlike, you know, The World Is, or unlike, you know, most of the band, I think they're isolated. Like, they don't have a scene. Like, they don't have like other bands they're cool with. I think, you know, they're very standoffish in a lot of ways. Like, you know, they don't, like, they've never tweeted once. You know, they hide out for years on end. You know, they don't have other bands in Vancouver or now Toronto now, where like they, you know, they're associated. They just, it's like its own thing. And that's why, you know, when they come back, you know, it won't be like, people won't think of like Celebration Rock as being like 2012. It'll be like, oh, Japan, like they just exist in their own, like, because even Titus, like, you know, they can be associated with like Brooklyn or like, you know, bands like So-So Blows and such. But yeah, this one just like is its own, like, it's like a fucking comet, you know?
Well, there
and I almost wish they'd break up. Like, I don't know how I'd handle like an okay Japan record.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how they follow up Celebration Rock.
Yeah.
But for now, Celebration Rock, a record great enough for me to name this podcast after it. So congratulations to Japan Droids for topping Ian's. Well, and you know, I would have named this podcast The Monitor, but it just doesn't have as good of a ring to it, I guess. So,
no, it doesn't. Or Lonerism might have worked, too.
Well, it might have worked. Well,
we'll love the nose.
Well, Ian, thank you for coming on the show and ranking records with me. I'm sure this will not be the last time you're on. So
I hope not, man. Thanks so much.
All right, man. Take care. All right, so that was Ian Cohen and me. We were talking about the best rock albums of the decade. I'm sure that there is absolutely no disagreement out there that you all agreed with every single choice we made. But in case you didn't, head over to our Twitter page at, again, our username is CelerockPod, C-E-L-E Rock Pod, and tell us what you thought and let us know your picks for the best rock albums of the decade. Thanks again, and we'll see you next week.